In my last video, The Tendency Towards Equilibrium, I described an economic concept that is so basic and fundamental that it is accepted by virtually everyone, including Keynesians, namely the law of supply and demand and its effect on prices. Surely this was just about the least controversial video I've ever made, or so I thought. Enter the so-called post-Keynesians. These geniuses think they found evidence to disprove the fact that prices are ultimately set by supply and demand. I mean, just to recap, when demand is higher than supply, we expect the price to go up, and when supply is higher than demand, we expect to see it go down. Similarly, we expect lower prices to increase demand and higher prices to decrease demand. This is such basic economics that up until recently, only the most stunningly stupid of Marxists denied it. But post-Keynesians may have trumped even them. What this boils down to is that a bunch of studies surveyed companies about their pricing strategies, and it turns out that many of them don't change their prices that often. In fact, around 35% of those asked only change their prices once a year, and 5% not at all. Drilling down further, only 22% cite changing demand as their main reason for the price change. This apparently is the stunning evidence from post-Keynesians to deny the general tendency towards equilibrium and the relationship between prices, supply, and demand. To make this argument, they lean on nominal price rigidity, which means that the price of a given product doesn't change over time despite fluctuations in demand. In fact, one of my interlocutors on Twitter, Lord Keynes 2, went as far as to say, and I quote, "Most businesses and corporations set prices on total average unit costs plus a profit markup to create stable profits. Most customers pay what is demanded." This comment left me momentarily stunned. Lord Keynes 2 is so focused on production cost, he's actually forgotten that every purchase is a trade to which both parties must agree. In fact, I tried to tell him this using the following illustration. There are a range of prices at which Lord Keynes is willing to buy, and a range of prices at which McDonald's is willing to sell. In this particular case, they might have sold him this burger from anywhere between 2 and 4 gold pieces. So why wouldn't they just charge 4? Well, they also have to take into account other customer profiles, other consumer preferences. This guy, for example, wouldn't buy at 4. This guy here would buy at 5. He really likes his burgers. In fact, what the company needs to do over time is work out a demand schedule. How many people would buy at this price versus that price? And then they have to work out what the trade-off would be to maximize profits. Lower margins but higher volume, or higher margins at lower volume. In this case, it works out that 2 gold pieces looks like the best bet. So we'll go for 2. We're writing off about 25% of people who would only take our product for 3 or 1 gold piece. And this is a calculation. It could be right, it could be wrong, but we hope we've gotten it right. And if so, those profits will come rolling in. But if we get it wrong, we'll make a loss. Now, it appears that Lord Keynes too doesn't seem to understand this. He says, and I quote again, "Most will pay a price well above what they would like to pay." Well, of course, 100% of people would like the good to be free. But as we've seen, we need to figure out what most people are prepared to pay while still keeping us in profit. And since they are prepared to pay it, by definition, it is mutually beneficial. That is, they value the 2 gold pieces less than they value the consumer good we are going to sell them. It is clear then that demand, that is, total number of people willing to pay at this price, is ultimately what is setting the price. But Lord Keynes continue to double down, going as far as to call neoclassical price theory bullshit. Now, I said that if certain products in the supermarket have stable prices, what they call nominal price rigidity, it is likely because they have relatively stable demand, which does not require very many price adjustments. And in fact, I pulled up several examples, totally at random, such as Fairy Liquid or Coca-Cola, showing very little changes to year-on-year demand. In such cases, we'd expect prices to change only with inflation. I also found examples, again at random, of products experiencing decreasing demand. For example, here's Tetley Tea, which saw a 17% decline in demand from 2013 to 2017. Did they slash the price? Turns out they did. There was a 13% price reduction in 2015. I also found that sales of McLane's toothpaste had decreased by around 40% in the same period. In 2015, the price of 100 millilitres of toothpaste was £2. Today, that same tube of McLane's toothpaste is selling for £1. What was remarkable about these cases is that they were taken purely at random, and yet our standard price theory perfectly predicted what would happen in each case. Lord Keynes too simply conceded this point and declared that these are flexi-price markets, but some of our other post-Keynesians were not convinced by this, dismissing these examples as, quote, anecdotal. So I challenged them to find me an example of a product with stable prices but fluctuating demand. And Lord Keynes, in fairness, came back with Coca-Cola, which famously had a fixed price of 5 cents from 1886 to the 1950s. Okay, so let's take a real close look at Coke to see if they somehow magically escaped the laws of supply and demand during this period. Why did Coca-Cola keep the price at 5 cents for 70 years? They had three reasons. First, their pioneering advertising campaigns had cemented the idea that Coca-Cola was 5 cents into the minds of the public. Second, vending machines all across the USA were designed to take 5 cents, and changing these would have been very costly. Third, it was actually their active strategy to keep purchase prices very low for the consumer by keeping production costs down and focusing on pumping out volume. In other words, this was an economy of scale. Here's a line from their annual report in 1922. The cost of manufacture has been reduced to such an extent that our prices to dealers, together with reduced costs to them of doing business, justifies and enables them to retail Coca-Cola at 5 cents per glass or bottle, as the case may be, which will have a very stimulating effect on demand. As long as this remained true, they could keep growing. Prior to the 1920s, Coca-Cola had only seen 2 years of sales declines in 36 years, and one of those was in 1918 when there was a 50% restriction on sugar usage issued by the US Food Administration. So, from 1886 to 1920, they had near constant growth in sales. And we can see this by looking at the actual numbers. From 1900 to 1929, Coca-Cola saw a 7,175% increase in total demand. And this trend continued into the years of the Great Depression. Unfortunately, the annual reports stop showing total gallons after 1931, but we still have data on the profits, and as you can see, they took a hit in the worst years of the Depression in 1932 and 1933. More on that in a moment. By the 1940s, Coca-Cola had become a national icon, and they even helped in the war effort, supplying Coca-Cola to the troops on a government contract. So what was driving up demand for Coke all through this period from 1900 to 1940? One factor, which is obvious, is advertising. Coca-Cola is probably the most famous brand in the world, and its marketing campaigns are the stuff of legend. But the second factor is obviously the low price point of 5 cents. Now, I should say that this is not as low as it might seem to you. To give you an idea, 5 cents in 1920 works out at about 63 cents today, but it's still pretty low. Now, although Coca-Cola's nominal price was fixed for all this time, its real price changed because the real price is always relative to inflation. So, if our price theory is true, we'd expect to see a fall in demand when the real price of Coca-Cola increased. And that's exactly what we did see. The real money price of Coca-Cola increased during the Depression because they had deflation, and we saw a drop in sales. In fact, we saw a 37% decrease in demand with deflation. This is also true of the early 1920s, when deflation made the real money price of Coca-Cola more expensive and demand fell. Between 1920 and 1924, we saw a 6.2% decrease in demand with deflation. In the 1930s, when inflation returned, the real price of Coca-Cola decreased and we saw a rise in demand, a 160.2% increase in demand with inflation. So what can we conclude by looking at this case study? Well, first, nominal price rigidity for Coca-Cola meant that the inflation rate effectively set the price. Demand was affected, therefore, by the real money price. With inflation, we saw increased demand. With deflation, we saw decreased demand. So there we have it. Nobody, not even Coca-Cola, can outrun the laws of economics. Now get out.